So welcome to the CMO Fractional CMO podcast, as we have recently rebranded and changed our name and all those kind of things, turned this into a series two. So welcome to that. My name is Simon Dell. I'm the CEO of CMO. I'm the host of this podcast. If you want to find anything out about CMO, CEMOH.com, come and find out what we do. We are Australia's largest fractional marketing network. And you can find me on LinkedIn, all those sorts of places, or email me directly at simon@cemo.com. If you watch this and you like what we do and think we're fantastic, please give us a review on Spotify or iTunes or whatever platform channel you're listening to. And if you think you would be a excellent guest on the podcast, if you are a fractional CMO or you are connected to the fractional CMO world in some way, again, please drop me a note and we'll see if we can get you on the show. Now, again, full disclosure today, my guest today is a lovely young lady by the name of Farah Motley, who also happens to be my partner and is also sitting in a room somewhere else in this house. So welcome to the show, Farah.
Thank you. No nepotism there.
No, none at all. None whatsoever. So we've spoken online before, because your background is law. So do you want to just give us the sort of 2 minute Farah history, and just sort of let everybody know what you do at the moment?
Yeah, sure. So, been a lawyer for just over 11 years now. So time is flying. I started out in private practice, working for a large law firm, and I went in-house, which means I was, an employed lawyer acting for, whoever my employer was at the time. And I've worked for a very large engineering company, an architecture company, one of the ones that's particularly kind of, relevant to CMOs is, a company that's a large international retailer, distributor, lots of advertising material, all of that sort of stuff. And also worked for a superannuation fund and a bank as in-house counsel, again, reviewing their kind of marketing collateral. And it's quite regulated in that space. So that was interesting. I started my own law firm just about 4.5 years ago now. So I'm the director of that. We're online, so we don't have a physical office, but we've got staff all around Australia and we help out lots of different types of clients, B2B space across Australia. They're in lots of different industries, so e-bikes, financial services, builders, architects, you name it. And we do some quite obscure areas of law like publishing and entertainment, but a lot in the marketing space as well, looking at compliance, privacy, all of those sorts of things.
Okay. Today, we're going to specifically talk about the implications from a legal perspective of being a fractional CMO. And there's obviously some challenges around that, multiple challenges around that. But I think probably the first question I wanted to ask you is more of a statement and just sort of get your opinion on this. When you are a consultant in any way, shape or form, be it financial, be it, be it marketing in this case, whatever, you have a certain legal duty of care to a number of different people, don't you? You can't simply go out there and give advice to people without there being an implication of you giving that advice.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, there's, I guess, for anyone who's doing, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but for anyone who's doing, you know, fractional CMO, I guess there's a certain level, baseline level of skill and experience that they tend to have, or they might not be a fractional CMO in the first place. And so clients are coming to them, relying on them for kind of sound advice in order to achieve a certain objective that they want to achieve. Most clients, hopefully, would be aware that, you know, a marketing campaign or a particular, strategy that's being developed to hopefully achieve a certain outcome, there's lots of variables that play into that. And so if that's not achieved, it's not necessarily the CMO's fault, but there is a line where if there was an obvious risk or something that the CMO should have told their client about, just as a means of good practice, that the client couldn't be expected to know because they're not the CMO, that really you should be upfront and telling them about that. So that's that duty of care piece. You know, if there's an obvious risk about something, that you should be, you know, making sure that you're addressing that with the client. And I'll put my lawyer hat and say, do it in writing.
Yeah. Well, I guess probably the big one would be, and again, you know, there isn't a huge amount of legal implications in running a marketing campaign, but I guess one of the challenges that a lot of fractional CMOs would face is the fact that they may say to a client, if you spend this money, we expect this kind of result. And yeah, I think everyone in marketing has been in one of those positions where they haven't had that result, or, yes, you know, they've had a much worse result than perhaps they predicted. Where does your liability as an advisor sit with something like that?
Yeah, so it's really about calling that out to the client. And I don't even think this is necessarily, you know, yes, it's a legal piece, but it's also that common sense, like making sure you're communicating with your client and building a good relationship with them. You know, if you make them aware that I can't guarantee this outcome, I think that this is going to achieve this outcome, but it might not. Here's some reasons why it might not. Knowing the risks that you might, you know, put in a significant investment into the strategy that I'm recommending, and you still might not achieve that outcome, are you still happy to go ahead?
Yeah.
So that if things don't go the way that it's planned, it's not even a legal problem. It's, well, you told the client that they shouldn't expect that the outcome's going to, well, absolutely certain, it's not guaranteed, you know, there's no guarantees around it.
And I guess from a client perspective, the reason for getting a fractional CMO in is that they've had enough experience to be able to predict a result in a relatively healthy, you know, with a relatively healthy margin of error. You know, because that's why they're there, because they've presumably done these kind of things before. They anticipate what could possibly go wrong and warn their client.
Yeah.
You know, of those problems.
Yeah. And it definitely does come down, and this is in any space, but it definitely comes down to how sophisticated is your client. You know, if it's mum and dad business, they want someone to step in and help. They've never done this stuff before, and they're, you know, it's kind of a first time for them. There's a level of, you know, you should expect there's like going to be a higher level of hand holding and saying, hey, you know, there's some risk associated with this. This is what that looks like, as opposed to working for an ASX listed company that has a big marketing team and you're stepping in and kind of guiding them.
I guess in this day and age, and you see this quite often, is potentially when a small business, and let's use your example, that mum and dad business, they may do something from a promotional perspective. They could be a cafe, a restaurant, or whatever, and they do something, and for some reason or other, it goes insanely viral and causes them, you know, it causes them angst, causes them anxiety, causes them challenges, and maybe even causes a huge queue of people outside waiting to spend money with them. So I guess there's an element where you are a little bit of the sort of the mercy of fate to a certain degree.
Yes. Yeah. And I can think of, you know, a few controversial marketing campaigns, like as an example, like some controversial social media post or advert or whatever it was, that's gone viral for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And it may or may not have had a really good impact on the business. But, you know, I think the more towards that controversy, or I'm really not sure how this is going to play out and it's kind of high risk.
Yeah.
The more you should be upfront and warning your client that, hey, this could go either way. Because imagine if you make a recommendation on something, it goes terribly, and that you basically wipe out their business.
Yeah.
It's So that's where as you know, that common sense approach, hey, here's an idea, but it could go really wrong or it could go really right. It just increases the, you know, the need to be really upfront and transparent and kind of do a bit of a deep dive with the client on all the possibilities that could go right or wrong. And then at the end of the day, the decision still rests with them. And that goes for, you know, any recommendations that a CMO is making. It's always about, you know, here's some ideas, but the choice on whether and potentially how to implement it is yours. And you're going to accept these risks that might be associated with that.
You said right at the start that these sort of things should be done in writing, you know, so you have that kind of paper trail. And would you sort of recommend, so if you're sort of, you're sitting in a strategy session with the client, you're writing shit on a whiteboard and all this kind of, this sort of thing, would be to come out of that strategy session and then detail what's been agreed.
Yes.
And send that forward to the client to go, hey, here's what we've all agreed.
Yeah.
In that session. And now we have that all in writing.
Yeah. Or even, hey, here's my account of, you know, just for record keeping, here's my account of that discussion we've just had. Just let me know if you have any comments. Because the thing about making notes or having something in writing around the time that it occurred is it's really good evidence, because people don't write notes thinking, oh, in 6 months, this particular issue is going to arise and you know, I should have this ready to go. It's usually quite truthful because you're just recollecting it without the benefit of foresight, knowing what's going to go wrong.
And I guess probably that's where, obviously in this day and age, we can be a lot more reliant on certain AI technology and AI tools to keep a track of things that are said in meetings so that we can accurately, you know, look back on those notes and go, okay, here's what we agreed and here's what everyone was, you know, that's probably an important tool in the CMO's, in the CMO's chest these days.
Yeah, 100%, definitely. Yeah. So, and I was going to say as well, you know, thinking through it and depending on the kind of role that the CMO is taking on, you might have a situation where, you know, you're making recommendations and overseeing a team that's implementing it. Maybe you're, you know, approving whatever goes out the door. What if, you know, one of those team members is, you know, junior or a little bit incompetent, or, you know, they're just grabbing images off of Google and putting them out into content. You know, you've got IP infringement, copyright, all of those sorts of things that could potentially go wrong. And you're not the one doing it, but you might be endorsing it and saying, yeah, this is good to go. You know, that's a bit of a risk as well. Are you saying that, you know, you're accepting responsibility for that piece of work because you've had the final say on whatever the outcome is?
Yeah.
Even though, you know, they're not your employee, they work for your client.
Yeah.
You know, all of those issues kind of, you know, this is where they can really be put out explicitly in the contract. Or, but, you know, I'm a big believer that you can have what you like in the contract, but if you're not kind of raising it at the time and just being transparent in the moment with your client, it's not very helpful to have to bring out the, you know, hopefully you never have to bring out the contract.
Yeah.
But even just from a client relationship perspective, where those things are coming up, like, hey, I've got a team of 20 people. You know, I'm not sure what tools they're using to locate images and things like that. You know, I assume that you've got protocols in place to make sure they're doing the right thing, and I'm not going to be looking into that.
Yeah. You I think when we spoke last time, which was one of the, I mean, there was a lot of interesting things, but one of the really interesting things is where you sort of said, if the client is doing something illegal or something questionable, you have a duty of care. That's your responsibility. It's, you know, if they're, and, you know, and you and I have had a conversation earlier today about pricing in retail and things like that, is that certainly there's certain things if we sort of say, you know, if you see your client doing something that you know is wrong,
yeah,
what should you do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the level of wrong.
True.
And whether it's said or it's in an email and you can't deny that you didn't get
Yeah.
it. But yeah, I think, look, CMOs aren't lawyers. Like, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. It's not part of your scope. But if it's pretty obvious to you that this isn't right, put it in writing. Say they should go and get some legal advice. And if they're asking you to, because if you've been made aware of it, you should speak up and say, this is wrong. You should go get some legal advice. But just from my, experience in the past, my understanding, this, you can't do this, and this is why. And if they're insistent, don't endorse what they're doing. Don't just go, oh, well, I told them that they should get some advice on this, and I'm just going to, push it ahead anyway. Because potentially you could get wrapped up in a misleading and deceptive claim.
Yeah. Okay. So that sort of then sort of brings me to the point around contracts and how important a contract is with your client, because I think this goes for a lot of contractors and freelancers, be they CMOs or be they graphic designers and things like that, is to sort of say, what length should we be going to get some sort of contractual arrangement with our clients prior to commencing work? And how detailed should that contract be?
Yeah, so I think, hopefully you never have to bring out the contract,
Yeah.
but at a very minimum, it should be in writing just so you can say, well, this is the fee we agreed on, and this is what I agreed to do in exchange for the fee. Like, just from a day-to-day, I want an invoice, and you don't want someone disputing whether they owe you that or not. That's like the first, practical reason why you should have a contract in place. But even going a step further, I think the level of detail of the contract or the things it needs to address, I think it does depend on the engagement itself. If you're doing something that's just really high level, you're just giving them some ideas, it's low risk, maybe something that's just really short and sweet is fine. But if you're, dealing with something that you think is high risk and, it can go wrong for lots of reasons that might not have anything to do with you, I think that's where it's probably appropriate to have a bit more of an intense contract. And one thing I get consultants, misunderstand, not just in this space, but in the consulting space more generally, is they think, I've got insurance. So if something goes wrong, it's my insurance that's on the hook. But your insurance doesn't cover you for everything. And once your insurance is exhausted, it's gone. Like, if you've got a million PI and something happens that's more than that, you're still on the hook. Again, the risk is somewhat lessened if you've got a company and all that set up. But if you're dealing with high risk work, then you might want to limit your liability. So if something goes wrong, you don't have to cough too much out of your own pocket. But I definitely think there's, for the high risk stuff, a little bit more attention to the contracts warranted.
There's whenever we do a mentoring session, or whenever I do a mentoring session for the Queensland government, they always used to start off by saying saying to the person that was getting the mentoring, the mentee, they would say, what you're about to get in the next 60 minutes is not advice. It's ideas, it's suggestions, it's guidance. They were very, very wary about using the word advice, as if that all of a sudden that tips you into a different category of support. Is that the case, or is that perhaps just the government being overly cautious?
I think it's the government being really cautious, but there's a line, right? Like, I know if something I'm saying to someone is legal advice or not, this is not, it's pretty obvious. But if a CMO is in a position where, they're having to, defend them pushing back on something with a client, and they start quoting sections of the Australian consumer law or something, you could just, you're obviously not a lawyer, Yeah. And you're obviously not giving legal advice, but you could just frame it like, this is my view. What do you think? Maybe you should go get some legal advice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was even more about just advising people. Cause again, in those circumstances, it was like, one of the pieces of non-advice I've given over the years, is that people sometimes shouldn't be in business alone. Some people are better having a partner or, you know, and all those kind of things. And often I've said, you know, for you to grow this business, it would probably be a good idea for you to have a look at bringing somebody else on.
Yes.
You know, my fear is then they go and find somebody.
And everything goes.
And everything goes pear-shaped. And then they turn around and go, well, that dude in that thing gave me the advice that I should bring someone on. Like, is that an extreme that, you know, perhaps we shouldn't be worrying about? Because I just think sometimes as a CMO, you might make offhand comments and throw out ideas, and all of a sudden these people go, hey, that's a good idea, and then act on it without your continued guidance.
No. So I've got a kind of parallel to this where I had to draft up a contract for a couple of businesses actually. So they did asset advisory.
Right.
Or it was similar stuff where they'd look at an old building, might be a convention center or something like that. And they'd look, okay, how could the client repurpose it?
Yeah.
And, you know, it almost straddled marketing a little bit in the sense they'd create like these, you know, examples of the types of people that might want to go there and demographics and things like that. And then they'd look at like the financial business case as to why this repurposing of this building might work and what you could do. But, you know, that's so broad. You can't, whatever they choose to do from there, you can't be responsible for that. Yeah. This is just an idea.
Yeah.
And so it was just, we had like, you know, half a page about how, you know, this is an idea. It's based on limited information. What you choose to do with that information is up to you.
Yeah.
You know, we've tried to make sure it's based on, you know, relatively reliable information, but when you're coming up with these ideas and concepts that are kind of out of your head and there's no reference point to it, it's not like, oh, I know that this is going to achieve this because there's another situation over here that's exactly the same and I can control all the variables. So, you know, to some, you can disclaim that, but it's just, I think it's equally as important to make your client abundantly aware of it in the moment rather than being like, refer to page 26 of the contract.
Okay, well, let's talk about also IP and that sort of intellectual property, because again, not so much from a strategic perspective, but, you know, with marketing, there's kind of a hand-in-hand strategic plus creative. And I often see these things where, you know, clients approach a graphic designer and say to the graphic designer, can you create me a logo and a brand? And the graphic designer goes and creates a logo and a brand. And then does this thing where they give the client the license to use that brand, but they still own the brand and things like that. You know, and then you find that you go, well, I've put together this campaign. Sometimes there's this blurred line, I feel, with consultants and creatives where they still feel that they own some of the IP of what they've created. Is that the case, or is that them holding on to something that isn't theirs?
Yeah. So I'll give you some scenarios. So let's pretend you're my client. I prepare a really terrible logo because that's not my space, but I prepare a logo for you with the new brand name.
Yeah.
And we don't have a contract, but you've paid me and I give it to you. Yep. There's an implied license that, you know, you have a right to use this. You know, it might almost be akin to joint ownership, where you and I both own it. I created it, but you paid me for it. So obviously you have to be able to use it. Let's say we do have a contract. Well, the contract should be really explicit about, do I own it? Do you own it? Do I have a right to use it?
Yeah.
All of those sorts of things can be very black and white in the contract. But as well, let's say I create it, I give it to you, and you go and register it as a trademark. And as soon as that trademark's accepted, I have no rights anymore. You have all the rights. Because once you register a trademark and it passes registration, you are the exclusive owner. All bets are off.
Yeah.
So, you know, it sounds great to go, well, I created it and it's mine. But if you're going to take that position, you're going to need to, you trademark it and you license it to your client. And then, I don't know, maybe you want to charge royalties or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a good, I think there was an interesting conversation you and I had a couple of months back about this idea that you can IP, you can copyright a strategic plan or a process. And I think that, you know, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but the point that you made was that, you know, AI is so sophisticated now, there's nothing that you can really create from a strategic plan perspective that the AI couldn't arguably come up with in about 30 seconds that would be as good, if not better, than something that you could come up with.
Yeah.
So you feel that that's the case in terms of trying to IP something that's a process?
Yeah. So whenever I talk to, you know, people in the marketing space, they often think everything's IP.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's just not. The whole point around IP and the kind of rationale for IP law and why we have IP rights is by allowing people to have the exclusive right to commercialize something, whether it's a trademark or, you know, a piece of a book, for example, subject to copyright, or a picture or a painting or whatever it is.
Yeah.
By giving them the exclusive right to do that, you encourage innovation, because they're only going to do that because they're going to get a benefit from it, which is generally to make money. And so it encourages innovation by allowing people to commercialize something, because only they have the right to do that and they can enforce those rights. But, you know, if I, let's say I've got a drawing of a, like an architect's drawing of a house, and they've got a door detail. That detail about how to build the door or what the door's going to look like is not IP. It can never be IP because it's not unique. And if you gave someone the exclusive right to use a door detail, no one would be able to draw a door detail on, you know, on the drawings, which wouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, just stuff like that. Not everything is IP. Now let's go to the ChatGPT piece. You know, there has to be a level of human intervention. So you can't, let's say I create something from ChatGPT. I don't interfere with it at all. I just use it verbatim, what the AI produced. And then I get really upset if someone else replicates it. There's been no human intervention in that process. And so there cannot be intellectual property in that. Now I can get, you know, I've seen this actually before when I've been reviewing manuscripts, where people have taken a concept, and one of them, I think I saw, it was like a commonly used business process kind of strategy, but and I Googled it because I didn't know what it was, and it had been used, you know, by thousands of people. It was on every other website. There were lots of books about it. It's not that concept, that idea is not IP anymore.
Yeah.
It's too commonly used, all of that sort of stuff. So there's a difference between something that's had human intervention, is new and unique, versus something that's not.
Let's go to the pointy end of being a consultant, which is the most important part of each, the getting paid bit. You've put a contract in place. Let's say, you know, you've got a contract, and within that contract, I would assume you would suggest mostly that there's terms for payment and things like that. Would you have that in the contract?
Yeah, absolutely. And as well, you know, what that looks like when you get paid.
Yeah.
It depends. Like if you're doing a set project and piece of work, like maybe if you don't know the client very well and you don't know if they're going to pay you, you have low confidence, maybe do it at milestones, like there's a deposit and then you're going to get the balance of the payment before you give them the actual thing that they're paying for.
Yeah.
But, you know, it, what you choose to do there, it really depends on the level of trust between you and your client, you know, your own cash flow as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me, for example, if I don't know the client, I will take, I can't take a deposit, but I will get half payment when I'm halfway through.
Yeah.
And then the final before I give the thing over, just so that you hold the control, because you don't want to have to waste your time and spend money trying to recoup a debt after you've done all that hard work and they've got exactly what they wanted, or, you know, they're raising some petty dispute about your work just so that they can avoid paying you.
I think one of the things we did, which I think has changed the business for the better, was look at security deposits. And I would suggest this to any consultant, irrespective of whatever space you're in, would be to create the idea of having a security deposit, which, and again, you tell me the legality and the benefit of these kind of things, but potentially having that security deposit which sits in a separate bank account, which is a, you know, a holding bank account, which is very clear to the customer that they get their security deposit back within 30 days of a job finishing or a contract finishing, but also that you can use that security deposit if they fail to pay you. If you sit there and go, well, you know, they didn't pay me for the last 30 days, I've terminated the contract, I can now claim that security deposit. Are those kind of things? I'm hoping you're going to say all those things are completely legal, because if they're not, we're in a lot of trouble. But
as far as I'm aware, yes. You know, there are professions that are regulated like mine, and unless I have a particular trust account with a particular setup, then I can't take money up front. But I'm not aware that CMOs would have that kind of arrangement. So, and look, all it comes down to is who holds the leverage to make sure you get paid. You want it to be you. And if you do have a security deposit type arrangement, or you're getting some payment up front before you've done the work and then drawing down, you know, maybe it's a red flag if the client has an issue with that and it's not a valid reason, because, well, do they intend to pay you when you do invoice? They shouldn't have a concern with it. So.
And if they haven't got the cash flow in order to pay you as a security deposit, you again, another red flag that perhaps maybe you shouldn't be dealing with them, or that there are going to be problems in the future. If you're in that kind of position, somebody does owe you money, what is the status? What is the process in Australian law in order to get that money back from people?
Yeah, so there's a couple of avenues you can go down. So, you know, lots of people send a letter of demand and then sometimes they just get ignored. A really good one, and there is a lot of, like, I'm going to say it as if it's just a really easy thing to do, but if you get it wrong very slightly, you're in a bit of trouble. But you can if your client's a company, you can issue them a statutory demand. So it's based, you know, and this can only be done if there's no dispute that the money's owing. Let's say you've followed up a few times and they just keep saying, yeah, I'll get it back to you next week. You can issue what's called a statutory demand, and it's issued under the Corporations Act. And it basically gives your client 21 days to either pay the money they'd have to apply to court to try and set aside the statutory demand. And if they don't do that, if they miss that 21 days, legally they're presumed to be insolvent. So whenever I've done this quite a number of times with companies, that this is basically how they cash flow their business, that they just don't pay for as long as they can. And then when someone issues a stat demand, they pay. So this one, I've done it against this same company many times, and they will jump on it as soon as they get that statutory demand. They jump on it because there's going to be a whole world of hurt coming down on them, particularly for the directors. If they keep trading after that 21 day period when they're presumed insolvent, that's a problem.
Okay.
So it's a really good stick to use.
Is that, I mean, again, my question would be, if you're a small trader, you're a small consultant, is that a how much does that cost in order to do
that? Look, if you are really savvy and really confident about your legal skills, you could possibly do it yourself. It's literally a form. If you Google statutory demand form online, it will pull up the form, and then you attach like a one-page affidavit, and it's basically from you saying, here's the invoice. It's still overdue. It is owing, you know, all of those sorts of things. So it max it's 2 or 3 pages, but there are a lot of legal rules around them. And if you don't get them right, you can be in a bit of trouble for, you know, you can't just start issuing statutory demands against people just as you like. There are some rules to it. So you need to tread a bit carefully. So I do recommend getting a lawyer to do that if you're going to. But look, we do stat demands for like $750. So, you know, depending on the amount of money that's owing to you and the likelihood that they'll jump on it really quickly, it's worthwhile.
Yeah. I guess this then sort of lends itself to the question with a lot of small consultants and small jobs. You know, if it's a job for $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000, you know, you're not necessarily going to go down the road of doing a $750 stat, you know, demand. You know, those are the sort of ones that you're asking for a bit more money. I guess probably, you know, your advice for somebody like this, I think you said it earlier on, is that staged payments.
I've had that before where it's such a small amount of money. If I start wasting my time trying to chase that, I'm going to be in the hole even more on that. So, you know, sometimes I'm just going to write it off because it's not worth my time. But, you know, maybe on principle, you're just going to go, I'm just going to chase it. Well, you know, you can go to QCAT. It doesn't cost very much to lodge a claim there. It's just it takes a really long time to recover.
It does.
You can get interest, but it just takes forever. Yeah. You know, if it were me, I'd go down to their office in person and I'd sit there until they paid my bill. But that's just me.
Well, there's a person that we know about that owes us some money, so maybe I ought to do that and wait till they have me ejected from the building. So, I say this is more of a comment, but I say this to those people that are doing those small jobs. I think the staged approach is the best.
It is.
Which I've learned a lot from a lot of web developers. Web developers slightly have a sort of a better grip on things than most people because they can always take someone else's website down, which is the ultimate kind of...
Exactly. He who has control.
Yeah, absolutely. The ultimate punishment. Oh, dear, your hosting's failed. Oh, what a shame, you know? Yeah. That sort of thing.
Another way you could do it, and I don't, you know, it depends on what you've been asked to do, but you could even give them something in read-only format until I get the money in the account. You can't actually download it. You can't do anything with it. You can see what I've done, but.
Yeah. I think to me, the best has always been the stage payments do the something like 50% upfront. So you pay for half of my work now. Mm. And then halfway through the job, you then pay for the other half.
Yeah.
So halfway through the job, you've had 100% of the payment and you've completed 50% of the job.
Yeah.
And then the client isn't necessarily feeling like they are out of pocket. And that approach, I then think, works really well. And even if the client sort of objects to that, you go, hey, well, why don't we do 25, 25, 25, and 25? You know, this job's going to take 4 weeks. You give me 25% of the money at the start of every one of those 4 weeks. By the end of the 4 weeks, I've got fully paid. You've got the work that you want. And if at any point you're not happy with it, you're not, you know, we can sort of stop and check again. So,
that's it.
You know, yeah, look, okay. So look, I mean, there's a lot of good advice there. I think there's a lot of challenges from a legal perspective that I don't think, many consultants actually consider. And I think this is probably the big challenge from when it comes to being a consultant. Anyone could sit there and go, hey, I'm a marketing consultant tomorrow with no previous experience, which is not quite the same as being a lawyer, where you clearly often have to do a lot of work to get to where you get to. But what about, I guess my last question today would be about those kind of misleading claims. I think, you know, we've all been in marketing long enough to know that some people in marketing tend to bend the truth every now and again.
Yeah.
The challenge is about, you know, saying who you are when you aren't that person.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I've had this conversation with marketing teams before because I've been negotiating a contract. We sent the proposal out, client says yes, and then we're negotiating the contract and I'm trying to tone the contract down a little bit, not promise so much. And they'll go, oh, but that was in the proposal document that your team sent. So why are you backing out on that now? And I'm like, oh, I need to look at the marketing collateral and tone that down as well. Look, there's a line, right?
Yeah.
If you make these wild claims and are not, you can't verify best in the world. Like you can't, certain things you just can't verify whether that's true or not.
Of course.
But there are some, particularly around product pricing and all of that. And I'm not sure that a CMO would have much involved in that way. But even, you've selected or endorsed a picture of a product that is not an accurate depiction of the product and someone thinks they're getting something for $100 that's far better than they're actually getting. It's a different product. You know, are you on the hook for that? It does depend on a lot of things, but you know, if you've put your name to it and they've relied on you, you've not warned them about it. You know, you've kind of failed in your duty of care because maybe you should have picked that up that it's not the product that you've been asked to put a campaign out on. It's misleading, deceptive conduct. That is such a low bar. Like if I'm planning on suing someone for promising something that they didn't deliver on.
Yeah.
I can go breach of contract, I can go negligence, but the easiest one by far is misleading deceptive conduct because all you have to prove is that whatever was said or done was not true and accurate.
Yeah.
So if it's slightly untrue, and it doesn't even have to mislead someone, it just has the possibility of misleading someone. So it's just so easy to prove. Yeah. And that's why if you jump on ACCC websites, splashed all over there. But that's why I say it's about like that risk analysis is what I'm doing or the thing that I'm involved in for this client. Is it high risk? Because maybe I should do some things to protect myself and push it back on the client. You know, even saying, hey, I've actually not reviewed anything to do whether this is legally compliant or not. You're going to have to go and do that. Make sure you do before, you turn it live.
Yeah.
Just stuff like that can help.
It all boils down to good communication. If you're communicating well with your client, if you're communicating your concerns with your client, that sounds like most of the time that's going to cover your backside.
Yes.
That's a fair statement.
Yeah. And it is. And as well, the times where I've seen or I've had to say to like marketing teams, hey, this is not quite right, is where they know. And the reason they've asked me in the first place is because they know they're trying to be a little bit tricky. Like if you're trying to trick the customer into think, having a certain perception or whatever, why are you having to trick them or, get into that space where it's turning a little bit gray now?
Yeah.
If you're staying customer and user focused, you should just be able to put all the cards on the table and trust that they'll come.
Yeah.
But if you're having to try and trick them to do that, that's where you're moving into hot water territory.
Look, there's an argument I think we've all lived in that, under the phrase sometimes fake it until you make it. And it's interesting. We had an application in for a senior marketing person probably about 4 or 5 months ago, and I looked at his LinkedIn profile and just the places that he'd worked just seemed to me to be not entirely accurate. It had been one of those ones where he'd somehow managed to do a fixed amount of time, 2 years. He's 2 years at, I think it was 5 or 6 of probably the biggest global brands that I've ever seen, all completely not connected in terms of categories or verticals. Okay. So like I can't remember what they were, but it was something like, yeah, I did 2 years at Coca-Cola and then 2 years at Microsoft. And you're like,
did, unlikely.
That makes no sense. So I guess my final point today, which is more of a statement than a question, is that there's times when you can perhaps embellish your own achievements and your own experience, and you can portray that in a certain way.
Yep.
But
on that thing, there is a provision in the Australian consumer laws, in this piece of law, but Competition and Consumer Act, it right. expressly prohibits being misleading and deceptive on the, you know, I'm trying to be a candidate, go for a job or whatever.
Right, okay. Fine.
So if you do lie about that, there's a specific provision that deals with that.
Right. And yeah. and I guess, but that would be more, I guess, for candidates for jobs, but I suspect that could be used
in a broader sense. Yeah, it's more broadly than that. Like if you're a fractional CMO and you're, you know, putting a pitch out to a client and telling them all about your experience and it's not correct, but on the basis of the experience they think you have, they hire you, that's also misleading and deceptive.
And then especially
if you're doing it to procure, you know, a benefit money.
Yeah. Okay. And then especially if you then fuck up in that role as well, when you've lied to get in. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, nobody do that, because that sounds like an extremely bad idea. So look, thank you very much for your time today. And, I think there's some super valuable information there. If a, fractional CMO, or if somebody on the other side of it is looking to engage a consultant and wants to make sure the contract's correct and that they are doing that, what's the best way for them to reach out and contact you?
Yeah. So our website's www.prosperlaw.com.au. We've got contact form on their phone number and email as well. So there's lots of ways they can get in touch with us. Even if it's just sense checking some marketing collateral, can do that for free over a short phone call.
And of course, you're on LinkedIn. There's not that many Farah Motleys out there, so it's not hard to find you.
Correct.
So thank you very much. Thank you very much for your wisdom and ideas and suggestions, not advice. We didn't get any advice today. We just got wisdom and ideas. but thank you very much for that. It's very much appreciated, and have a good rest of your day. He's saying this with you're in the other room, but have a good rest of your day.
Thanks for watching, everyone. Bye.